back at it again. The crux, the heart of the Christian path brings us to an empty tomb with Jesus risen. And what I find fascinating is that as the Christian path developed over the decades, the centuries, the earliest Christian writers began to reflect, what does it mean that the tomb is empty? What does it mean that Jesus is risen? And for the past 2 years, I've been very captivated by how the writer of Hebrews speaks to the essence of Jesus' death and resurrection. It says this, it was to free us, free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. And so not only does Jesus' death and resurrection breaks the power of death, it breaks the power of the devil, there's this emotional element to it. The resurrection event can help liberate us from fear of death. Now, for some of us, this makes total sense. This sounds like good news. We know ourselves to be afraid of death. But the interesting thing is Nexus is always challenging me, and I know many, many from here, in fact, who have told me over past Easter Sundays that they don't fear death and don't think much about death. And, you know, it's hard to tell someone that they're enslaved to fear of death if they don't think about it much. And so this morning, I want to talk about fear of death, the emotional nature, address sort of both groups, those of us who know instinctively what it means to fear death, those of us who that just doesn't resonate. So first, for some people, I think anxiety about death is very real, very acute sense of it. But why? I mean, beyond the sort of finality of it or mystery behind what lies beyond death, why does death frighten us? Why does it enslave us in fear? I want to suggest a couple of things this morning. The first is this. I think we fear death because our lives are haunted by the threat of time running out on us unexpectedly. We've been working through this Anasazi People series. And you remember 2 weeks ago, if you were here, I told you the story of how the Anasazi settlement of Sand Canyon Pueblo, and it was a horrible massacre there that archaeologists have uncovered. The evidence of the site suggests that some kind of warring Anasazi party had come through and viciously attacked and killed the people living there. What happened from archaeologists discovering the site clearly was very grisly in nature. For the people living there, death came very swiftly and horribly. And a couple of weeks ago, I was doing research for that Sunday, and I was flipping through these grainy photos of the pottery and other artifacts that have been uncovered at the site. And I came across this piece here, and it hit this weird nerve with me. You ever have those moments when you see something, you can't stop staring at it? And this was one of those pieces. It was weird because the tag line underneath this simply said, unfinished seed jar found at Sand Canyon Pueblo. And I found myself, I was just staring at this unfinished piece of pottery. Had this moment like, in some ways, this piece sort of sums up my entire fear of death because my imagination began to run wild thinking about this piece. Sat staring at it, kept thinking about how maybe the day of the massacre had played out. Kept thinking about maybe some Anasazi person sitting like they do every day, working on their craft, working on their pottery, and maybe having a seat over top of it, slowly trying to paint it in. You can see the right side is finished. The left side still needs some work. And I kept picturing this person sitting there, maybe slowly painting in the piece of pottery. And then maybe at some point, while sitting over top of it, he or she just hears a scream. We're under attack. And just like that, time for whoever this person was had run out. Like there they were, just going about their daily business, doing what they do every day. And suddenly, death comes swiftly. Maybe they put down their paintbrush. Maybe they stood up, grabbed something to try to defend themselves. But in a few moments, Their life was done. Their jar left unfinished. I don't know. It rocked me. It was a weird experience because this seemingly unfinished jar, when I look at it, all I can think of is that the lives that it represents. People caught, their lives ended in the middle of their days. This seed jar left undone as if time had simply run out unexpectedly. And at that moment, looking at this piece for the first time, I realized that my entire fear of death was captured in this one piece of pottery because I'm terrified about my time running out unexpectedly. That's what scares me about death. Because we all have our plans in life, right? I've got plans for later on today, this week, summer vacation, next year, next 10 years. I got my plans laid out. And we tend to live in this autopilot mode. We assume, of course, there's going to be another day. Of course. But I think at the back of our heads, the fear of death hangs over us because none of us know how much time we're dealing with, right? We sort of tend to live our lives as if we have unlimited tomorrows. And the fear, I think, is that our lives will end the same way that this jar did, unexpectedly and unfinished. And I think we fear death because in the back of our minds, we're working with a clock none of us have control over. We fear death, we are haunted by the prospect of time running out unexpectedly. The small hope resurrection gives me is that maybe time doesn't have the final word. Or beyond time running out, I think we also fear death because it represents the loss of everything. Everything we love about life is lost at death. Everything that brings meaning and purpose and joy is taken from us when we die. And so we know exactly what it means to be in slavery to the fear of death because some of us, we live our lives haunted by the specter of loss. My son Huxley had to have an MRI about a month or so ago. He's got this weird old man shake when he eats. He's just, it's like an old man eating soup. It's weird. And after a while, shaking, we thought we'd take him to the doctor, see what was going on. They did some initial tests. They're like, we're not really sure what's going on. And then they said those words. We want to send him for an MRI. MRI? Why? Well, we want to rule out some worst-case scenarios. And in that moment, right, I was like, Kristen was a little bit more deeply affected by it. I was like, all right, whatever, do that. And it didn't affect me until the day of. We got down to London, and they said, okay, we're going to put a mask on him. You'll hold him. He'll fall asleep, and then we'll do the test. Oh, no big deal. So we get in the room, and they're like, okay, you need to hold Huxley really tight. We'll put the mask on him. It's a little bit of laughing gas, and then he'll go to sleep. And so they put the mask on him, and I'm holding him tight, and he said, count to 10, Huxley, and it's laughing gas. So he starts laughing. One, two. And he's counting, and then right at the end, he struggles a bit, and then he passes out. And right in that moment, I'm holding my unconscious boy, and then the questions, the what if. What if this is the last time I'm holding him, and he's healthy? What if there is bad news? What if everything changes today? What if suddenly the clock starts running today? And you know, the reality is this. If I'm being an honest parent, I love Huxley about 33% of the time. I'm just trying to be real with you. Okay? The other 66, it's frustration and boredom. But 33% of the time, I just love the guy. Love him. He brings me joy. And that's exactly the point. There are things in life that bring us joy. And the reason we fear death is because it spells the loss of all the things that make life worth living in the first place. Our lives are haunted by the specter of loss. In fact, Brené Brown has some interesting research around the connection between joy and fear. And what she has found is that the very things that bring people joy are also the things that make people feel most vulnerable and exposed to loss. So she's done a lot of research on this. She's compiled a list in her research of the top 10 things people name that bring them much joy, but also bring them fear of loss. These are them on screen here. standing over your children while sleeping. This week, has anyone seen the movie Lion? A few. It's about a five-year-old boy who disappears on a train and he's lost from his parents for 20 years. And I watched the trailer. I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't watch this movie. That's going to devastate me. No, forget it. I'm going to watch that. But I just watched the trailer. 2 minutes of it. And then I walked up. My kids are sleeping. Oh my goodness, don't get on a train and disappear. Like I just, oh. Just from the trailer. Or acknowledging how much you love your partner in life. I don't know if I'm the only one who has this weird thing, but I grew up, my parents are here this morning, grew up where the last thing you say when you leave the house is, I love you. That's the last thing you say. And it's sort of carried on. The last thing that I say when I leave the house is, I love you to Kristen. Doesn't matter. She could be at the other end of the house. So I'll be like, hey, hey, what? Love you. Boom, gone, out the door. And I've been thinking about that. Why do I do this? And I realize that it's the prospect of, I don't want to leave the house one day without saying that and possibly never come home. Because I'm just imagining Kristen at a funeral one day, right? So I'm like, oh, that's tragic. Brad died unexpectedly. What were his final words to you? For being like, it was profound. He said, I'm going to Burger King and left the... You know what I mean? Right? Like, can you imagine leaving your loved ones with something so not profound? So every time I leave the house, love you. Let those be my final words. It's weird. All these things, they bring us joy. They also bring this fear of loss. I had a friend read me a story this week about his 97-year-old father. And it rocked me because he talked about, for the first time in his life, having to help his father use the washroom. And how the roles have suddenly changed. His father, who was a beacon of wisdom to him, suddenly he's now in the parental role, trying to help his father understand what's happening to him, helping him use the washroom. All of these things, we think about our parents and we love spending time with them, and yet there's this always this thing hanging in the back of our minds. Could be lost. And what Brené found in her research is joy and fear of loss, they go hand in hand. And with this fear, one of the things that she talks about, one of the things that we do in order to cope is we do what she calls practicing foreboding joy. We do this by rehearsing tragedy in our minds. We ruminate about worst case scenarios, kind of like I did with Huxley. In that moment, I'm rehearsing. Okay, if it's bad news, then this. We rehearse these in our minds. She says this, we're trying to beat vulnerability to the punch. We don't want to be blindsided by it. We don't want to be caught off guard. So we literally practice being devastated. And you know, when the writer of Hebrews talks about being enslaved to death, it's not so much, oh, I don't know what happens after I die. It's not so much, I don't like the finality of it, perhaps. It's this stuff. So I'm scared of the loss, the pain that it will bring. This is precisely what it means to be enslaved by the fear of death, rehearsing tragedy, that haunting feeling in the back of our minds. We don't know when time's going to run out. Our fear is that death will rob us of joy and all the things we cherish and adore about life. And so when Scripture mentions us being enslaved to a fear of death, some of us can totally relate. Maybe you're here this morning going, okay, yeah, I get that. But this is the fascinating thing to me. What I found is that whenever I talk about fear of death, there's always a second group of people for me who this idea is just confusing and incomprehensible to them. And this is always my surprise about Nexus. Someone who's like, no, that doesn't make sense to me. In fact, there's probably a lot of you going, this is a little bit morbid, Brad. Can we get to, you know, the party part? I've got a turkey in the oven. Let's go. Let's get to the happy part. I could say this, the notion of not being scared by death, it has befuddled my mind for like 2 years. I'm trying to think through, what does the passage of this like mean for those who don't instinctively sort of sense a fear of death? Here's what I want to ask. Maybe you're here this morning and you don't think a lot about death, but I want to ask this. How many of you here this morning are tired and exhausted? Quite a few. You know, and I don't mean just you didn't get enough sleep last night. I mean just tired and exhausted. I am. I don't explain it. It's weird. I'm just feel like I'm running on fumes. And many people today that I encounter seem to run into people who are just wearied by the state of the world, right? Like, this is too much. Or there are people who are running on fumes at home. They're taxed by work. They're drained by duties in life. Some of us are just so sleepy with our social calendars and social media. We're busy. Everyone's busy. Everyone's tired. And this is what is intriguing to me. So many of us today, I think, feel tired and depleted. We're running on fumes. Our tank is empty. And what I want to suggest to us all this morning is this. It might not seem like exhaustion is a manifestation of our fear of death, but I believe it really is. Being tired and worn out are manifestations of being physically, biologically worn down and depleted. Being tired and exhausted is really about you coming to terms with your finitude. Whenever we run up against our limitations in life, it's a symptom of our fear of death. And this fear can produce the worst in us. I came across this quote by Lynn Twist, and every single word just resonated with me. So it says, for me, and for many of us, our first waking thought of the day is, I didn't get enough sleep. Yeah, that's my first thought of every single day. The next one is, I don't have enough time. That's also my second thought. She goes on, whether that's true or not, the thought of not enough occurs to us almost automatically before we even think to question or examine it. We spend most of the hours and the days of our lives hearing, explaining, complaining, or worrying about what we don't have enough of. Before we even sit up in bed, before our feet touch the floor, we're already inadequate, already behind, already losing, already lacking something. By the time we go to bed at night, our minds are racing with the litany of what we didn't get or didn't get done that day. We go to sleep burdened by those thoughts and wake up to that reverie of lack. This internal condition lives at the very heart of our jealousies, our greed, our prejudice, and our arguments with life. Fascinating. Being run down is a reminder that we're finite. It reminds us that we're all running down. This experience of being tired and exhausted, it's death whispering, I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you. Oh, I didn't get enough sleep. I don't have the energy. I don't have the energy. I don't have time. I'm coming for you. What we're feeling is our own entropy at work. I hate entropy. Law of entropy states, I'm not a scientist, I don't get this entirely, but it says that the entire universe is heading towards something called thermal equilibrium. Put simply, the energy in our universe is running down. The sun is burning out. Eventually, the sun will expand and cool, settle towards equilibrium. Everything in the universe will become so cold that no life can exist. Every single light in the universe is going to go out. Of course, it'll take millions of years. We don't need to worry about that. But there will be an end to the earth as we know it, just like there's going to be an end to each of us. Cosmologists call this direction of the cosmos the arrow of time. And what this all means is simply this. Decay is the clock of the universe. Decay and dissolution, they mark our time. They mark our days. Every birthday is basically like, congratulations, you decayed for another year. And sure, we can fight it. We can fight it, but it's ultimately useless. I love when people say, I'm in the best shape of my life. That cracks me up. To me, it's basically like jumping and saying, I can fly. You're coming down. You might be at your peak height, but you're coming down. Entropy is like gravity. Everything around us winds down. It stops and it dissolves. Our cars, our homes, our books, our friends, our families, our universe, us. When we feel tired and exhausted, we are experiencing the arc of the universe. Our own entropy, our own microcosm of decay. In fact, I'll say this, every time you go to bed, you're experiencing entropy, a little death, a reminder that entropy is at work. You wind down and decay every day. Sleep is like a microcosm of what's going to eventually happen to all of us. It's funny, after 12 years of marriage, I feel like Chris and I, we still argue and fight a lot, but just now about silly things like socks and toenails and books. It's just nothing serious anymore, just things that annoy us. And one of the things that annoys each of us about each other is our bedtime routine. It just, 12 years, it's still the same. Kristen is one of those people who likes to read in bed. And for most civil people, when you get to the point where you're about to fall asleep, you close your book and put it on the bedside table. Not Kristen. She reads to the point of just passes out reading. And then there's books. And so I'm always annoyed. In bed, I'm like, there are books. I'm rolling over on them. Like, can you just, when you know the end is coming, can you put down the book? She has her own beefs with me. I don't know about you, but every day my routine is kind of like, get up, have those first two thoughts, didn't get enough sleep, get some caffeine, and then sort of, okay, ramping up afternoon, oh, supper with kids, get them to bed, and then it's like, okay, all right, I got a little more in me, I can do this, it's Brad time. And one of the things that drives Kristen nuts is I always spend, no matter if I work in the evening, whatever I do, I always watch like an hour of TV right before bed. But I'm always fading. You know, it's 12 at night, I'm fading. And I don't know about you, but when I fade, the clothes start to come off and my socks are always the first to go. And so right before bed, I'll be on the couch watching TV. I'm like, oh, I should just go to bed. I take my socks off and sometimes I clip my toenails and... You don't clip your animals, but I have this habit of leaving them on the couch. And Chris is like, are you serious? Every morning I got to wake up to your socks, toenail clip. I'm like, when it comes time for bed, I'm done. There's no energy. I say, Kristen, I don't even have the energy to pick up my socks and bring them up and put them in the dirty clothes hamper. She's like, that's crazy. I'm like, but I don't. I head up to bed, it's like, oh, forget it, I'll deal with it in the morning, right? How many of us get that at night? You're just, there's no energy. Just, done. It's a mini flow of time. Every day is like a rehearsal for death. Think about that when you go to bed tonight. It's the flow of time. Death fills every second. No matter what we do to reduce entropy, this victory, it cannot be maintained over the long haul. And so we all fear death to some extent. This is what I believe the author of Hebrews is getting at. Fear of death is something much larger than, oh, I don't know what happens after death. No. It's bigger than that, more expansive than that. For some of us, fear of death is simply, I'm scared time's going to run out unexpectedly. Some of us, it's this worry about all we're going to lose when we die or someone we know dies. For others of us, it's just the fear of our own limitations. And this is why I think so many of us spend so much of our lives frustrated. You can't beat entropy. You can't hope to fight it and win. But this is also why this Easter, there's a resurrection story that caught my attention, but it's not Jesus's. It's not Jesus's resurrection story. It's Lazarus's. And this story has given me a great deal of hope because there's a little tidbit in it that I find fascinating. As it is told, Jesus has lost a good friend. A man named Lazarus has died, and he's distraught by the loss of his friend. His sisters Mary and Martha are in mourning. And Jesus arrives on the scene. Something remarkable happens. Jesus raises Lazarus back to life. But that's not what I'm interested in this morning. Jesus had raised other people back to life before. No, there's something else here. Take a look at how the story concludes. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind men have kept this man from dying? Jesus once more, deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave and with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there's a bad odor for he's been there for days. Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When he said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. Now, here's what I love about this story. It's not just about death. Jesus had raised other people before. No. This is a big deal because death wasn't the enemy. The enemy was entropy. The enemy was time. The enemy was decay. Notice the reason. Don't open the tomb. Why? Entropy has won. Jesus, too much time has passed. Decay has already set in. Jesus, there's a bad odor in there. It's the stench of time. It's the stench of decay. It's the stench of entropy. He's been in there for 4 days, an unembalmed body, rotting. The power of the story is not only that Lazarus was brought back to life, but that Jesus reverses 4 days worth of decay on an unembalmed body. Time and entropy are reversed. And this, to me, gets at the heart of the power of resurrection. It's not just about bringing life to death. It's about reversing time, entropy, decay. It's not just about resurrection. The miracle is about the reversal of the tidal flow of time, stopping and then reversing the clock of the universe. And I don't know about you, but I hate the tyranny of time. Because the reality is, for me, a lot of days it feels like the real Lord of the universe is actually time and decay. I hate that time threatens to run out on us and leave us left with lives unfinished. I hate that death and time promise to take all the things away that we love. I hate marking time by watching things around me die. In the end, time wins, decay wins, entropy wins. But when I think of Jesus, the empty tomb, when I read John 11, I don't know, these days I've got a little bit of hope. And my hope is this, that after the clock of entropy ticks midnight for the cosmos for each of us, my hope is that there will still be a final word left to speak. My hope is that the clock can be stopped and reversed. My hope is that for all the ways this earth has decayed, for all the ways my heart and your heart have decayed, for all the ways our bodies have decayed, for all the ways our minds have decayed, in the end, there's something greater than time and death and decay. And I find that in the story of Jesus' resurrection. I'm going to ask the band to come. Get set up now, because here's the thing. This Easter at Nexus is a little more subdued than usual, and it's because this Easter is for the exhausted ones. This Easter is for you, the scared ones, the hurting ones, those who have lost, those who are in pain, those of you here who are weary, you're running on fumes. For the ones who have known the pain of time running out on them unexpectedly, lost someone you love. For those of us who live in the fear of losing the things we love most in the world. For those who are worn down and weary and running on fumes. This morning, my hope is that resurrection may still speak a word of hope to you. In a world where time steals what we love, in a world where we know the pain of loss, in a world where fear holds our hearts, my hope in resurrection is this. Beyond the Lord of time, beyond the Lord of loss, beyond the Lord of fear, and beyond the Lord of decay, there is another Lord who speaks a final word in our universe, and it is this. Behold, I'm making everything new. I'm making all things new. And that's the hope. Hope that all things can be new again. That it's never too late to start over. Nothing is irrevocable. No betrayal is final. No sin is unforgivable. Every form of death and decay can be overcome. There isn't any loss that can't be redeemed. There's no form of loss or death or decay that can't be reversed. In the resurrection, we're assured that there are no doors that are eternally closed.